This is The Inquiry on the BBC World Service with me, Helena Merriman. Each week, one question, four expert witnesses, and an answer. It's evening on the 25th of May, and George Floyd has gone to buy cigarettes from a shop in Minneapolis in the US. He's 46 years old, used to work as a bouncer, but lost his job after coronavirus hit. George Floyd pays for his cigarettes using a $20 bill, and then he leaves. A few moments later, one of the shop's employees calls the police, saying he thinks George Floyd paid with counterfeit money. The police soon arrive. They walk over to George's car, pull him out, and handcuff him. As they try to put him in their police car, a struggle begins. And that's when police officer Derek Chauvin turns up. After a scuffle inside the police car, Derek Chauvin pulls George Floyd out of it, and George falls to the ground, face down, still in handcuffs. People around them start filming as Derek Chauvin places his knee on George Floyd's neck. In the mobile phone footage, you see George Floyd lying there. He says, "I can't breathe," over and over again, 16 times to be precise, and he pleads with the police to get off him. At one point, near the end, as he gets more desperate, he even calls out for his mother. It's only when the paramedics arrive, after George has gone silent and his body limp, that Derek Chauvin finally takes his knee off George's neck. He's held it there for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. Later that night, George Floyd is pronounced dead. Last Friday, Derek Chauvin was charged with his murder. And since then, riots have erupted in cities all over the US in outrage at this police violence. And that's because George Floyd's death is just the latest in a very, very long line of police killings of unarmed black men. 5 years ago, here on The Inquiry, we made a programme looking at why this was happening. That was after the death of Walter Scott. Since then, there have been hundreds more deaths of black men at the hands of US police. So this week, we've gone back to that programme to see whether things have changed. Depressingly, it seems the answer is no. So here again is what we found when we asked, why do US cops keep killing unarmed black men?
Part 1. Missing numbers.
I grew up in Orlando, Florida. I'm a black man. It's incredibly depressing to see people just like me who have been killed.
This is Sam Sinyangwe, a researcher and activist who started a project called Mapping Police Violence.
I started the project really to provide answers in the wake of the shooting of Mike Brown on August 9th, 2014. I've documented and read the stories of 12-year-olds who were killed by police. It's very deep and heavy to read these stories, and yet it feels like the right work to do. It's important to tell their stories.
If you go looking for government statistics on police shootings of unarmed black men, you'll be disappointed. There aren't any. And that's because there's no official comprehensive tracking of police killings in the US. The FBI and others count some police officer-related deaths, but there are big gaps in the data.
There are statistics on all kinds of violent crimes, and yet when it comes to people being killed by police officers, there's no data on that. And that really, a light bulb went off in my head.
Sam Sinyangwe decided to collect his own.
I looked at two crowdsourcing databases, which actually collected all of the names. What I then did was go through those articles, the media reports listing each of those people who was killed.
And from that data, he worked out how many people have been killed by police each year. Last year, in 2019, he says that US police killed 1,099 people. 263 of them, that's 24%, were black. And that's against a black population of just 13%. On his website, Mapping Police Violence, Sam Sinyangwe breaks down those numbers even further.
I actually identified whether they were armed or unarmed. I identified them by race, by looking at, one, if there was an obituary online of them, if there was another picture of them online.
On his website, he has an animated map of the US, and red pins light up to indicate every person killed by a police officer. There are so many, it looks like a firework display across the country. Click on a pin and a name flashes up. Gavin Williams, Joni Block, Kendall Wilson, Samir Nicholson, London Faith Strawn, and many more. The youngest was aged one, the oldest 84. And there's a special section on the website too for those who were unarmed, over 100 of them with their names and their photographs. One of the most important details to take away from his data is this.
Black people are 3 times more likely to be killed by police in the United States than white people. They show that actually more unarmed black people were killed by police than unarmed white people last year.
So what does Sam Sinyangwe think is behind this?
I think it goes back to this question of, you know, how do they perceive young black men? How are black people in general perceived in America? And I think there's not as much value assigned to their lives.
So unarmed black men are being killed by American cops because of racism, he says. That would explain the numbers. But beyond these killings, is there other evidence that shows that US cops are institutionally racist?
Part 2. Implicit bias.
I am a white, middle-class professional woman. I enjoy a great deal of privilege based on my demographics. And I saw in myself not only that privilege, but also implicit biases that I had about other groups.
As well as white and middle class, Laurie Friedel is a professor of criminology at the University of South Florida. She's also very candid.
I certainly have the black crime implicit bias. I am more likely to see threat in African Americans than I would Caucasians.
She's thought a lot about bias over the years. It started when she became director of research at the Police Executive Research Forum in the late 90s.
The issue of racial profiling was the number one issue facing police. And I came to understand two things that didn't go together in my head. One, bias in policing was not just a few officers in a few departments. And I also came to understand that overwhelmingly the police in this country are well-intentioned people. And I couldn't put those two thoughts together in my head until I was introduced to the science of implicit bias.
Implicit bias. That's in contrast to the explicit kind, which you could describe as overt prejudice. Instead, implicit bias is about something less conscious.
We all have implicit biases, whereby we link groups to stereotypes, possibly producing discriminatory behavior. Even in individuals who are totally against prejudice, bias, and intolerance.
Take what's known as, quote, black crime implicit bias. Bias revealed by research carried out in the US, showing that many people link African Americans to crime, violence, and aggression. That research is partly based on experiments called shoot, don't shoot.
The original shoot, don't shoot studies has a subject sitting in front of a computer monitor, and photos pop up very quickly. And it's either going to have a white man or a black man. And then that man is either going to be having a gun in his hand or a neutral object, a cell phone or something like that. And the subject is told, if you see a threat, hit the shoot key. And if you don't see a threat, hit the don't shoot key.
What they found is that people were quicker to shoot an unarmed black man than an unarmed white man because of implicit bias. Laurie Friedel says that sometimes this bias can be so strong that police dehumanize the people they're dealing with. A report looking at cases where Philadelphia police had killed people added some interesting details about how susceptible police are to implicit bias.
One of the things they looked at is what they called threat perception failure. The officer believed that the person was armed, and it turned out not to be the case. And this report found that these threat perception failures were more likely to occur when the subject was black.
80% of these so-called threat perception failures in Philadelphia involved African-American suspects. But here's something that might surprise you. Black and Latino officers were just as likely to make these mistakes as white officers. Now, you can't prove that implicit bias is behind this, but Laurie Friedel thinks it's the most likely explanation.
Officers, like the rest of us, have an implicit bias linking blacks to crime. So the black crime implicit bias might be implicated in some of the use of deadly force against African Americans in our country.
So one of the reasons US cops are killing unarmed black men is that their implicit bias leads them to view black men as a threat, says Laurie Friedel. But Is this bias understandable? Though some argue that America's justice system over-criminalizes African Americans, the experience of some cops on the street is often that black people are more likely than white people to commit crimes.
An important message in our training is that stereotypes are based in part on fact. And we have to recognize this because in our country, people of color are disproportionately represented amongst the people who commit street crime. But we go on to say that does not give you license to treat every individual in a group as if they fit the stereotype. That's where we go wrong.
So if implicit bias is partly to blame, what's the solution? Laurie Friedel says the first step is for officers to acknowledge their implicit bias, then to challenge it by interacting with the people they're biased against. In other words, getting cops out onto the streets of black neighborhoods.
Maybe they're in a high crime, high minority area, making sure that they're playing basketball with the young kids, meeting with the business owners, the fathers that are trying to keep their kids out of the gangs. That positive contact can help reduce their biases. It can also impact on the stereotypes that those young kids have about police.
So why are U.S. cops killing unarmed black men? We've heard that the implicit bias of many white, Latino, and even black officers might lead them to view black men as more of a threat than white. Now, that would explain why more African Americans might end up in a cell. What it doesn't explain is why so many end up dead.
Part 3. Warrior Cops.
First rule of law enforcement is to go home at the end of your shift.
This is Seth Stoughton, a former cop.
The key principle is officer survival. That's what all of that training is designed to promote. But it ends up endangering civilians rather than preserving their safety.
Seth Stoughton was a police officer for 5 years, then left for the calmer confines of academia. He's now an associate law professor at the University of South Carolina. But he's not done with the police. He spent the last 8 years studying them, focusing on one aspect in particular, the use of force.
The warrior culture, the warrior mindset, the belief that police officers are soldiers engaged in battle with the criminal element. That mindset and the training has really contributed to some shootings that were most likely avoidable.
And this warrior mindset doesn't begin on day one of police academy. It starts well before that.
This is the Orange County Sheriff's Academy.
It starts in police recruitment videos that show officers shooting rifles, strapping on hard body armor, using force. That attracts a particular type of candidate, and the police academy further entrenches this idea of the police warrior.
And how does it do that?
It teaches officers to be afraid by telling them that policing is an incredibly dangerous profession, to assume that everyone around them is a threat until proven otherwise. And I want to emphasize that. Officers are trained to view every encounter as a potential deadly force incident.
So give us an idea of some of the scenarios that you might be taught or worked through when you're a new recruit.
You walk up to a person who is loitering outside of a convenience store. Their hands are in their pockets. You, as the officer, begin talking to them, and without saying a word, they pull a gun out of their pocket and begin shooting you. You pull over a vehicle, and before you can even fully get out of your car, the driver of the vehicle gets out of their car, points a gun at you, and begins shooting at you, and so on.
So when officers are faced with a tense situation, their warrior training kicks in, he says. It's what some say happened back in 2014 in the case of Eric Garner, a black man selling cigarettes outside a shop. Officers approached. Eric Garner was verbally abusive. They put him in a chokehold and, like George Floyd, despite him saying he couldn't breathe, The police kept that chokehold going till Eric Garner died. The two techniques used by the police in these killings, a chokehold and a knee to the neck to two unarmed men, are either forbidden by many police departments or only allowed when a police officer's life is under threat. In neither of these cases were the police at risk of their lives, yet their warrior training still kicked in.
That's one example of the difference between de-escalation and a harder approach that the officers used more quickly than perhaps they needed to.
Seth Stoughton says this warrior cop mentality developed in the 70s after a few high-profile incidents where officers were killed. And it resulted in the police developing a very different attitude towards survival to the military.
When the military is designing a mission, they have in mind the fact that they're going to lose soldiers. The police profession has strongly repudiated that notion. No officer fatalities are acceptable.
It's as though over the past few decades, a calculation has been made by American police that civilian deaths are an acceptable price to pay to minimize police deaths. But that calculation isn't final. Some states are beginning to make changes to police training, encouraging officers to find other ways of resolving situations without using force. Ironically, one of the first places to announce it would be ending the warrior cop training was Minneapolis, the city where George Floyd was killed. When the mayor announced this ban on that training last year, the president of the police union was furious, calling the ban illegal and saying the union would continue making the training available for any police who wanted it. It's clear that warrior culture is embedded in the police, and it will take years, generations to change.
If all of the states had the same approach and the same numbers of officer-involved homicides as the best states, the states that had the fewest, we could expect about 300 to 600 lives to be saved every year.
So why do US cops keep killing unarmed black men? Our expert witnesses have built up a picture for us. A picture of a US cop, whether black, Latino or white, who's been trained to view every scenario as a potential threat. An officer who may well have an implicit bias against African Americans. But there's a missing piece in the picture. Why are so many black unarmed men coming into contact with US cops in the first place?
Part 4. The bigger picture.
I spent 30 years as a member of the Chicago Police Department, 9 as chief in D.C., and now I'm here in Philadelphia. It's my calling. It's what I was put on this earth to do.
Meet Charles Ramsey. He's a veteran of big city policing. In 2014, he was handpicked by President Obama to co-chair a task force looking at how to repair trust in the police. The raw anger in some American cities right now reminds him of the days when he started out as one of the first African-American police officers.
1968 was a period of time when there was a great deal of frustration, confusion. A lot of that was aimed at police, but it did cost me a few friendships.
The 70-year-old former police commissioner went right to the top, and it gave him a bird's-eye view of some of the problems. His view is that it's not just the police at fault here.
No, we live in a society where everybody wants to point fingers, but we have a lot of deeply rooted societal problems. Poverty, education, the housing stock in many instances are poor. We got to deal with the issue of extreme poverty. I mean, Philadelphia, of the major cities in the United States, has the highest rate of poverty. You have an underground economy that supports many of these neighborhoods, drugs, prostitution, illegal sale of cigarettes.
And it's crime born out of this poverty, he says, which helps explain why so many young African Americans are coming into contact with police in the first place.
Why are police in large numbers actually in some of these neighborhoods? We have to deal with the reality that there's a disproportionate amount of crime occurring in many of these same neighborhoods. So we need to find the right balance.
But how do you find the right balance? Because while we focused on victims of police violence, the police themselves are sometimes victims, too.
On the other hand, we've also had several police officers shot here in Philadelphia, killed in the line of duty. So there is violence that takes place against police as well. And I think all that needs to be taken into consideration.
So Charles H. Ramsey tried something new in Philadelphia. He divided the city into separate zones, assigning a team to each one.
They have monthly community meetings to talk about problems of crime and disorder. New cadets that come out of the academy are assigned to foot patrol right away. They don't automatically go into cars. And I do that so that they actually get to know people in these challenged communities, good folks that are there and trapped in certain conditions.
It's back to that idea we heard about earlier, getting groups who are biased against each other together to challenge those stereotypes. And that strategy might be working. Under his leadership, with strategies like this, crime came down. Other US cities have also reformed their use of force policies. For example, San Francisco, Baltimore, Chicago, Denver, and they're now teaching de-escalation as an alternative to deadly force. And here's what's most interesting. In cities where that policy was implemented, the number of police shootings dropped. It's why former Commissioner Ramsey is in favor of new training that gives officers skills in de-escalation as well as armed response.
Putting them in scenarios where they have to make decisions, they have to exercise good judgment, and being able to critique that so that when they are in these real live situations, their reaction, their response is really more consistent with what the actual threat is.
So why are US cops killing unarmed black men? Imagine a street in a black neighborhood with high levels of poverty and crime. A cop turns up to deal with a situation involving a black man. He instinctively views that man as a threat. As the situation deteriorates, his warrior cop training kicks in. He shoots. The solution? We've heard that it's about training to counter both implicit bias and the warrior cop outlook. But it's about poverty too. So no quick fix solutions then. But Samson Yangwe says there's an important, achievable first step.
There's something in the United States called Vision Zero. And Vision Zero is a commitment by mayors to achieve zero traffic fatalities in a specified time frame. And yet, we haven't seen mayors step up and make clear commitments to reducing the level and eliminating the level of police violence in their communities. And I think that says a lot about the relative value that they place on those constituents' lives.
If there's a commitment to both count and reduce the number of those killed by cars, why no government commitment to count and reduce the number of those killed by cops? It wouldn't solve the problem, but it would send an important message. Someone is watching. This inquiry was presented by me, Helena Merriman, and produced by Estelle Doyle, James Fletcher, and Phoebe Keane.